Leviticus chapter 10, verse 3, we're doing the Rashi, second Rashi. And it says, in front of the whole nation, I will be on it. So Rashi says, when a Kadosh Baruch Hu punishes the righteous, then the public fears, exalts, and lauds God by saying that if by these, then certainly by the wicked. And therefore, they fear, exalt God, by exalt means make great God and praise God. Now, I could understand the fear of God that they could have, but where is the made great and the praise? Okay? That's the question. In other words, when the righteous are punished, in this case they were killed by God, that was the punishment, I could understand the Kal V'chomer, like he says, that if by these righteous, they get punished, or certainly the wicked, so I could understand that I'd be afraid. When I see them being punished, I could see fear. Where do I see that I'm going to make God greater, I'm going to praise God? I see fear of God. I don't see praise and making great. That's like a certain level of awe. I stand in awe of God. I'm looking at God as something special. Where's the special? I'm afraid I'm going to be punished. There are two types of opposites. There's one type of opposite like movement and non-movement. That's a qualitative difference. But then there are different levels of movement. Okay? Like, for instance, there's walking, jogging, and running. So there's different levels of movement. So the first type of opposite is a qualitative difference. The second type is a quantitative difference. And every quantitative difference has a subject. Like, for instance, if I say hot, warm, and cold, you would tell me that the subject is temperature. Wherever I can make a comparison between one thing and another, okay, like this, not every comparison, where I say that I in Cain, if this is true, then that must be true, like in the way Rashi is saying, he's talking about levels, okay? So he's saying he punishes the great, right, the leaders, therefore he will definitely punish the wicked. So therefore, since it's a quantitative difference, Rashi is saying there's a quantitative difference, there must be a subject. The question is, what is the subject? In other words, where God punishes the great, the righteous, and I say that therefore he'll definitely punish the wicked, right? So the thing is, the difference between the righteous and the wicked, God is saying there's a quantitative difference. Okay? I want to know what is the subject that he's measuring. In other words, how could I say that if this is true, then this is certainly true, unless there's a quantitative difference? Once again, when we say that there's a quantitative difference, okay, that where God punishes the wicked, where God punishes the righteous, he will certainly punish the wicked, what is the subject? If there was a qualitative difference, I can't say certainly. If A is true, then certainly B is true. If they're qualitatively different, there must be a quantitatively difference if I say certain. Now the question is, whenever there's a quantitative difference, it must have a subject. And the subject is God's justice, okay? God's justice. In other words, that God, it's telling us something about God's justice. Okay? That's what the subject will be, something about God's justice. Okay? Now the question is like this. If we're talking about God's justice, or God's punishment, okay, like Zach wanted to say, we're talking about God's punishment. We punish the righteous, then we'll certainly punish the wicked. Okay? Well, That's an obvious thing. Why do I need Rashi to tell me this? What is Rashi teaching me different than, in other words, if there is a, in other words, what Rashi is saying is there is a system that God punishes, okay? So since there's a system, then God, then there's a quantitative difference in this system between the righteous and the wicked, how God punishes. What is Rashi trying to negate? In other words, what would I have thought without Rashi? Or like we say, what's the Havamina? Okay, what would I have thought without Rashi? There is an infantile view of how authority works. And that is, their view is that the favorites, when a favorite does something wrong, he's overlooked. But when I do something wrong, then I'm not overlooked. In fact, you will find that's many times the argument in class. The argument in class is, how come you didn't punish him and you're punishing me? Your argument is saying that the teacher is unjust and he is not using the same system of justice for one person as another, and therefore the teacher is playing favorites, and therefore it is unjust. It's not a system. You see? That is what Rashi and what Kiddush Hashem is, sanctifying God's name. When God destroys the righteous, and according to Rashi, they were the greatest people of the time. They're even greater, according to Moshe, what he says to Aaron. They were even greater than Moshe and Aaron. Okay? When God punishes them, he removes the unconscious or infantile view of justice that authorities choose favorites and they overlook punishment when they're relating to the when they're relating to their favorite. So therefore, God's justice is equal for everybody. There's a system, and the system applies to everybody equally. Not favorites. You cannot consider yourself a favorite, and God will overlook some sin because I did 25 right things, so therefore, God looks at me as the good guy, so therefore I could, or a righteous person, and therefore God will overlook one of my mistakes. If you do something that is wrong, it deserves consequences. There are two consequences. There's consequences in the laws of nature, and there's consequences in God's system of justice. There are consequences, and we don't care who does the wrong thing, there will be a consequence. And that is shown when the righteous, the people on the highest level, die doing God's will, or in this case where they made a slight mistake, okay, and God does not overlook that mistake because they did all the other things correctly. That is Kiddush Hashem. That is sanctifying God's name, because then everybody recognized that it's a system, and it's not a personal thing. The statement was made that, in other words, it could be that God relates to these people because he holds them to a higher standard. The answer is that in itself would be unjust, because that is not a system. It's not based on a system. It's based on he's holding them to a higher standard. You must see how, why. It is true that maybe a person on a higher level is related to differently, it is possible. But you have to understand how that works according to the system. I can't hold him responsible just because he's on a high... You should know better. You understand? Maybe you have to explain it according to the system. Okay? And our Rashi is not talking about this problem. It's not talking about the problem that I'm holding him to a higher standard. Higher standard means that it's not a system. Unless I could explain it according to the way the system works, so I could show why it relates to him and not to the other person, but it's within the system that it relates to him. And not, like for instance, let's say for instance I don't know the laws, and I see a fire engine go through a red light, and somebody else simultaneously goes to the red light, and the police stop the other guy and not the fire engine. That is unjust. Why are you holding him responsible, not the other one? So I have to explain that the other one has priority and why it has priority within the system. Now you're saying the same thing on a superficial level. For some reason they're held to a higher standard. But I can't understand that unless I see within the system how the system explains the difference. Why is there different levels? That is the question. And how does the system work that there are different levels? But Rashi is not dealing with that particular problem. So therefore, we won't discuss it. The question that we're discussing today is how to find happiness, and the first step. There are many steps to happiness. I would like to give you the method, the first step of happiness. I see we have to make a definition, the difference between pleasure and happiness. Pleasure is physical. With the physical world, like for instance, on a hot day, I jump into a cold pool, so it gives me physical pleasure. Let me put it another way. When you feel pleasure, there could be three causes. One is based on fantasy. I daydream, and I feel good. You understand? So the fantasy, or I do an action based on fantasy, and it makes me feel good. Okay? Secondly is caused by the physical. And third, there is a pleasure caused by learning, where I see the ideas and I enjoy the ideas. None of these three is happiness. Happiness means I could sit and do nothing, but I have no conflict. It's not a positive thing that I feel good, it's that I don't have conflict, nothing bothers me. Happiness is the removal of conflict. Physical pleasures, like on a hot day, I jump into a cold pool. I'm hungry and I remove hunger, I physically feel good. There is an emotional experience as a result of enjoying the physical world. You feel good, or a fantasy, you have a daydream and you feel good. You understand the concept and you feel good. All those three, that feeling good, that's the result. Let me try to explain it a different way. There is an emotion that causes you to make a decision. Let's say, for instance, I want to take vengeance on you because you did something to hurt me, and so I insult you, right? I insult you, right? So then that the emotion of vengeance is emotion that causes me to make a decision. That's not what I'm talking about. But when I see that you are hurt by the thing, by the insult, then I feel good. That's pleasure. I feel good because I see your pain. In that case, I see your pain. That's a psychological type of pleasure. That's the psychological, that I feel good when I see you in pain. There's a real physical pleasure. I eat something when I'm hungry and it removes the hunger, or I drink something that removes the thirst, so that's a physical pleasure. And then there's a pleasure as a result where my mind sees an idea clearly. I enjoy that. Pleasure is the result of some action or something happening in the physical world. Happiness is simply I'm in a state, a certain state, without conflict. I'm in a state, I have no conflict. There's nothing bothering me. I'll give you an example. Let's say you hear about a friend that's very, very sick, dangerous, okay? So you feel bad. Then you hear that he's cured. So you feel good. So the idea makes you feel good. It's not that you enjoy the idea, but that the knowledge there's a certain state that you're in. Even that's not a good example. That's not a good example either. I'll give you a different example. This is an actual case, okay? A woman came to me, a child died, and she was very, very unhappy. Okay? Of course. But anyway, in talking to her, see, there's two things about when a child dies. There's one is the loss of the child. That's a very deep thing. They have that's very deep. I don't know if I could deal with that. That's a different problem. It's a much deeper type of conflict and unhappiness that we're not going to deal with. We're talking about the first step of happiness. But I noticed also in the discussion, she blamed herself for a child's death. Okay? So I asked her, was she negligent? Or did she do anything? She didn't do anything wrong. So I said, so why are you blaming yourself? So she says, because I sinned. I did wrong things. God is punishing me. Okay? So I explained to her that God doesn't work that way. I showed her. And I showed her that it's the laws of nature. It had nothing to do with God killing the child. It was not her fault. She walked out a different lady. She walked out totally. She accepted it. And she was not... In other words, you can't take away the loss of the child, but the guilt was taken away just by a change of view. Her view was that she was the cause of a child's death via doing something wrong, via sinning. And then when I showed her that she was not the cause, you see, so then she was happy. It was just a difference in her view of that situation. Okay? In fact, that's why we call things hashkafa. Hashkafa means a view of life. Hashkafa is there to change your view of life. But we're talking about hashkafa from one aspect, the view of life, how different views of life can change your whether you'll be happy or not. In other words, the question is that, well, maybe I relieved her a little bit, but you can't say she was happy. See, when you use happy that way, the word happiness is not the correct word. You're using pleasure. No, I did not cause a pleasure, but I removed the conflict. She was relieved. She still had the conflict that her child was dead. That's a separate problem that I couldn't help her with. Okay? That's a very deep problem. But the thing is, the guilt that I was able to remove. So I removed the conflict. That is the area of hashkafa, of how that different view of life. It's not an act, it's not pleasure, just removes the conflict. It removes a conflict. Each conflict that's removed, you're closer to complete happiness. Unhappiness is when the conflict is working. So you're unhappy because of the conflict. It has nothing to do with the result of the physical. It has to do with how you view life. It's a view of life, okay, that will make you unhappy or happy. The word hashkafa, okay, there's different hashkafa. Like, for instance, there's a view of God. There's a view of how God relates to me. There's a view of everyday life. There's different areas. I'm only discussing hashkafa, your view of life, and only how it relates to the removal of conflict. That is the thing. I'm dealing with happiness. The first step in finding happiness, how your view of life removes conflict. That is one aspect of hashkafa. Hashkafa means a change in your view of life. I'm only giving examples of your change in view of life only insofar as it relates to the removal of conflict, which is happiness. Okay, I'd like to give you another example. You're raised that you have to go to high school and then go to college because you have to make a living. Okay? I'm accepting that. I'm not discussing that really school should be an area of learning. I'm not discussing the idea of learning. I'm accepting that your premise that school is to get you a job, and therefore you have to go to high school, you have to have certain grades to get you into college, and then to from college you have to have certain grades and then get a job. Okay? Now, so most people feel that now according to our society, we always take 4 years to go to high school. Okay? Let's say I don't have, in other words, and most people, they feel the pressure to always be, to make sure I work hard in every class, they work to memorize, they stay up late, and they try to memorize, and they try to get wherever they're supposed to get each year, and in the 4 years graduate high school. But you don't realize there's different ways of operating here. Different ways. First of all, if I cannot do that, the question is, why can't I do that? Do I don't have the ability because my mind is not good? I don't have the ability because I can't memorize, and there's a lot of memorization here. I don't have the ability because I have difficulty with language. I don't have the ability because I can't force myself to work 18 hours a day. You have 8 hours of school, nine classes, none of them basket weaving. Each one, practically everyone, has homework and tests, right? You have to be in the room sitting and operating a certain way during all this time. Let's say I don't have the ability. So therefore, the first thing is to know if you can do it, or if you're just going to barely pull through and forcing yourself to operate in a situation which your nature is not created to work at. In other words, the society has a certain demand upon you. Now, that demand that the society has upon you, you might be able to live with it or you might not be able to live with it. If you're not able to live with it, can you work it out some other way? I'll give you a simple example. What would be the catastrophe if you graduated high school in 5 years or in 6 years? So you go out to work 2 years later than you thought you would. What would be the catastrophe? What would be the catastrophe if you go 2 years to community college if you can't go straight to a regular college and then from there go to a regular college? What happens if you take 6 years to go to college? Well, maybe you can't do all the work in 10 months and then have 2 months off. Maybe take a lesser load over the 10 months and then go to summer school. There are many different ways. This has to be worked out with the counselor and your parents. It has to be discussed because you might look at it, you have an emotion that you want to finish with all your friends, or you have an emotion, yeah, that's a good idea. Maybe I'll just sit around and take 6-7 years to graduate high school because you're lazy. You understand? But really, you could do it. You understand? So therefore, not to make any mistakes, what you do is you sit down with a counselor, or in this school we have a few, you know, that you can talk to, and what type of a college you could get into and how you could still satisfy your what you want to do, how you could still accomplish it, and then you talk it over with your parents, with the counselor, and then you work it all out, and you have a plan that would take off the pressure, but you still have the same results. You see? That once you would see that idea, and you could accept that idea, that would be the removal of conflict. Just the very idea would remove the tension, and definitely the way you operate. But you have to be able to think outside the box. If you could only think and operate the way the society demands of you, there will be many situations which is not for you. But if you could think outside the box, you could accomplish the same thing that is necessary to be accomplished, you see, without the tension. I don't know if a human being could live tension-free, but I'm saying you can lower the tension and you can lower the conflict just by changing how you view life, that you have to be able to think outside the box. By outside the box, I mean outside the parameters of our society. The same thing, like, for instance, jealousy, living according to other people. So let's say you have a friend that has a $1 million house. You have to work for that $1 million house. That's a tremendous amount of tension. But if you would lower your standards to $200,000 house, $250,000 house, there's less tension because there's less work, less taxes, less upkeep. So you could do it with less work, less tension. If you look at work that is never enough, there's constant tension, constant driving, you can't stop. But if you look at work as a matter of making money, and you study statistics of what a person needs, and all these statistics, usually insurance companies have it, is that how much money you need in insurance, how much money you need in the savings bank, and then what level of life you want to live, what you need, and what you need for retirement. All these things is a finite number. But many times when people go to work, it's not finite. They can't stop working. They're greedy or they're stingy, and so therefore it becomes infinite. And therefore there's always an unbelievable amount of tension. The tension is much greater than just looking at it practically that I have to make a living. Yes. In other words, you have to be able to look at life. There's a certain view of life. Many times it comes from the infantile part of our mind, an unconscious part of our mind, that we look at life in one way that drives us in a certain way. We have to be able to open our minds to look at it from a different angle, and that different angle will relieve the tension that the emotional way cannot. You see? So therefore, it always has to see how I'm looking at life now and how to look at life in a broad way, in a broad manner, so that I can see it from different directions and see a direction that would fit in best for me. The way to train the mind to open your mind to looking at things different ways is many, many different examples. Mishlei shows you many examples, comparisons between the righteous and the wise on one side and the wicked and the fool on the other. But practically all, not all, but practically all the examples that they give is they show the consequence of the life of the wicked. Okay? That's also a certain view of life, that you see that there's certain consequences of living an irrational life. But there's also just the view of life like we've given here, the examples that we gave here, just looking at it from that way, not from looking at it from the consequence point, but to look at it from the tension point of which life causes more tension and which style of life causes less tension. They need a certain amount of examples, you see? Enough examples to open your mind to be able to think about it from different angles. That, I think, is the first step towards happiness. I don't think it's the last step, but it is the first step. The question is like this. Let's say, for instance, a person is very unhappy in life, so go and become a hermit. The answer is that's running away from life. That is trying to put yourself in a physical situation that will get you out of conflict. That is not the way out of conflict. Changing your situation in life is not the way out. It's the view of life. Then you might change your situation in life. That might be a practical result. But the happiness comes from the change of view of looking at life from a different angle. That you have the ability to look at life from different angles. In other words, a person that lives the life of pleasure is making decisions more and more towards the physical, and therefore more towards the life of conflict than away from it. The removal of the life of conflict comes through contemplation and through thought, and thinking through that the what life is all about and what is the true view of life. Okay? It depends in which direction you're going. You're going towards the physical, that's going to lead you more towards conflict. I'm not saying you cannot partake of the physical world, but I'm talking about the life of the physical. It's a different thing. In other words, you can partake of pleasures in the physical world. You should. But the life, that's also two views. What is the difference between where pleasure is running my life or where I partake of a pleasure? Making that type of distinction, where and when I should partake of a pleasure and where I shouldn't partake of a pleasure, where it's affecting my view of life and where it's just the enjoyment of a pleasure, that's also a difference in the that deals with the view of life and will make a happiness or unhappiness. Right, we're giving another example of happiness, okay? If you'll notice that most people, like let's take for instance conservative and liberals in the political arena, right? Now, they hold from certain positions, and they're usually extreme in their positions. Like abortion is wrong, or any you can have abortion anytime you want. You'll notice that the Torah and the laws of abortion have, there are times when you can, and there are times when you can't. You understand? There's a certain emotional view of life, which is like very religious. The very religious life is, there is no thought, this is wrong, this is right. For instance, lying. People hold, lying is wrong. Or some people say, it's okay to lie. You know what I mean? Or they live their life, they might say it's wrong, but they live their life that it's totally okay to lie. The Torah makes a distinction where you can lie and where you can't lie. You understand? Happiness, the view of life from the happy life is someplace down the center. In most cases, there are distinctions when you can or when you can't. But if you hold the total picture, then you should know then you're probably driven by some emotion, and therefore that would be a lack of happiness. It's not looking at life objectively, but there's some emotion that's controlling and forcing you to look at life only from one angle and not be able to see it from any other angle. You have to be look at life from both angles, and usually the answer lies someplace in between the two extremes. You understand? Like, for instance, the people that are interested in the environment, they do not care and they do not think about jobs. Only the environment. On the other side, the manufacturers or the lumber companies, they only think in terms of making money or jobs. It lies someplace in between. You have to take in consideration that people need jobs and there's environment. And somehow the two have to, you can work out somehow that you can have both. But what happens is the arena of politics, the arena of the world, when they start making decisions, they go from one extreme or the other. There's no compromise, there's no thinking through and working through Maybe it's someplace in between, or maybe we could satisfy both. And both have to be satisfied for us to live in this world. We need an environment and we need jobs. Both have to be satisfied. How to satisfy both, that has to be worked out. But usually there's business which thinks in terms of only money, and then there's environment who thinks only in terms of the environment. But nobody works it out practically, which is someplace in between. That is the problem. So happiness is a view of life where you could see the extremes and be able to work it out someplace in the middle in the correct way that would satisfy both extremes. Sean asked the question before we started. The question is that he hears ideas and he sees the discussion, how it works and all the steps, but he wants to know how to imitate or to get there, to be able to do that which is done through the discussion. He wants to be able to do it on his own. The first thing is don't try it on your own. Okay? The thing is that there should be a review of the material even after you understand it. Now, there's a difference between memorization and review. Memorization means I just go over it, but the mind is not working. Review means that I go over each step. It's as if I never saw it before. Each step has to make sense and go over each and every step. Okay? What happens is after you go do this hundreds of times, then after a while it starts affecting you and you start thinking that way. Now you will find as you review it that first of all you'll have new insights. If you're reviewing and not memorizing, you'll have new insights that you didn't see before become clearer. And two is you'll have questions that you didn't have before that it doesn't make sense. And as you find answers either on your own or by bringing the question back to class, but through discussion, so slowly but surely, your mind starts thinking in a certain way, and then naturally you'll find that you're doing that which is the right thing to do. It just suddenly become natural that your mind will naturally ask the questions, or when you're thinking of an answer, your intuition will go in the right direction. Okay? You can't force it to happen. It comes by review. You have to wait for it to happen. But the only way it will happen is through constant review. And I know there's different personalities. Some people could review a thing for many, many times, you know. Some people can only review it a few times. Each according to their personality, when their mind cannot function in a clear way, when they're just starting to memorize and not reviewing, so then move on to a new area. Another discussion that we had, okay? The second step is, in the discussion, you have to notice that there are two different areas of investigation. One investigation is figuring out what the verse is saying. That's one method. Abstracting from the verse the idea. The second is to make sure that the idea fits in reality. If you abstract an idea from Proverbs and it doesn't fit into reality, so then there must be something wrong in the abstraction. So the mind, one is through abstracting from the facts, the idea, and the second is the more of an application to see how it works in the physical world to test it out. Like many times we'll have an idea and people say, one minute, there's a situation like this or that this principle doesn't work. So the thing is that's a test on the principle which we abstracted from the verse. Those are two types, areas of logic. Most people move towards the second kind. They're able to grasp the subject, and they're involved in discussing the subject, especially the subject of Proverbs, which deals with everyday life. So everybody has experiences, and everybody has an understanding of it, so you can immediately get into the discussion. But people shy away from abstracting because that's very, very formal. It's a formal logic, and it's a little more difficult, and it takes more training. But the truth is, if you did ask the questions there, that would probably train the mind better. Okay? And it's more valuable in everyday life, because the way you use Proverbs is not to remember this or that principle, but learn how to abstract in a certain situation that you're living in. You want to make a decision, so you abstract the principles that would apply from the situation. You don't go back to Proverbs, but like I said, this way of thinking should be second nature, so that in everyday life you start thinking that way. So it's important to do the abstractions from the verse and to see those methods of doing it. We're in a question was asked of me from the book Wounded Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. In there is quoted that there were 700 Indians that were in a certain place, they gathered in a certain place, and Jesus came down to them and said that he went up to heaven and he became an Indian. He didn't want to have to do anything with the white people anymore, and he's going to get rid of the white people from America, and the Indians will get their land back. Okay? So the question was that it's obviously not true, that prophecy. Why? Because you see, the white man is still in control. The Indian is not. And yet that's secondary information. You have 700 people, enough of a group to say that it is not secondary information that should say that yes, this was that Jesus really did that. That this really happened. Okay? So the person was asking the question, therefore there should be no proof of Mount Sinai, Har Sinai, because you see that secondary types of proofs does not work. And here you see a proof that they had secondary information, but it did not work. Okay? That was the question. In other words, the original 700, it was not secondary information. That was primary information they saw. But however, to me, that's secondary information, so I should have to accept it based on my proof of Mount Sinai, right? But yet the facts tell me that that secondary proof is incorrect. Okay? So therefore the person that questioned says, therefore you should not be able to have a proof of Har Sinai. Okay? Even though there are only 700, but it's still enough of a quantity to have secondary to be a proof of secondary information. In other words, it's still a mass conspiracy. You're going to have to either accept mass conspiracy or 700 people made a mistake. It's enough of a quantity that it should be equal to the proof of close to the proof of Har Sinai. I would say Har Sinai is a little more probable, is less, but it's the same thing. It's secondary information, and then we have primary information that contradicts it. So you see that secondary information does not work. It comes out in the second class. In the first class, nobody said anything, and everybody accepted the facts as is. Now people are saying that that was not in the book, that only very few people saw it, but they told the other 700 about it, okay? So I don't know the facts. Clearly, that a whole question might be illegitimate. The whole question might be totally wrong, okay? So it doesn't have the facts. But even assuming that the facts are correct, okay? Even assuming that the facts are correct that way, I would like to still continue the question. Could somebody please check out the facts for me for tomorrow? I'm willing to accept the facts. I don't know if it's correct or not, okay? that we'll have to see, we'll have to check out. But there is a certain understanding here that I want to bring across. So therefore, I am accepting the facts just to bring out this, to bring out the idea how I would answer the question, accepting the facts as they are. The proof of Har Sinai is based on that I must make a rational, and I don't always have primary knowledge. Okay? So the question, so I must make decisions based on secondary information. On secondary information. Okay? So the proof of Har Sinai, the proof of Har Sinai is based on a certain level of proof. There are different levels. In other words, in life, life is not always clearly black and white. There's certain security that a person has, an infantile security, that everything they accept is 100%. There's no doubt in their mind. Whatever they accept, there's a certain total security in accepting that. But the truth is that the psychological security that a person has nothing to do with reality. And you have to, in reality, evaluate the type of proof and the level of proof that it is and on what basis you're making it. Okay? Secondary knowledge is a certain level of probability that you cannot live without. It's the most logical way of operating. If you do not operate on secondary information, you can't operate. You can't deal with anything. In other words, you go to a doctor, you see a certificate. That's secondary information. Primary information is if I went to all the classes that the doctor had, and then I saw him with all his patients, so I know his experience. That is primary knowledge. But if you tell me that he had 1,000 patients and he was successful on all of them, that's secondary information. And yet I make decisions. When I see a certificate that he went to a certain school and he graduated, that's secondary information. So you can't go to a doctor. There's nothing you could do. Your mother tells you the food she's serving you is kosher. You don't know. She went to the store, not you. That's secondary information. Practically every aspect of your life is based on secondary information. You cannot live without it. But you have to know it's not the security of 100%. It's not a security of me seeing the thing with my own knowledge, that I had the experience with my 5 senses that I had the experience. It's not equal to that. But it's a level of truth that I must live with. You understand? And if you cannot live with that, and you go back, you need the security, the infantile security, so then your whole life is based on belief, because you don't trust proof. You don't trust secondary proof. Even primary proof you probably won't accept. You'll accept something you believe the way you were raised. You will accept that 100%. You need a fantasy type of security that doesn't exist in the physical world. That is the difficulty of the transition from the emotional life to the intellectual life, because you're giving up a certain level of security that might not be in reality, but it's satisfying. It's extremely satisfying. But you must give that up for the security of reality, which is very different than the fantasy type of security. So therefore, we say there are 2 levels of proofs. There's secondary knowledge and primary knowledge. Okay? Now, where you only have secondary knowledge, you must rely on it. And it's only a certain probability. In fact, Sadhguru says, what is the formula for making decisions? When you see something with your mind, let's say you only have secondary knowledge, and you see with secondary knowledge that this is true, then you must accept it 100% and have the security that it's 100% correct. But you must have the humility that when you get the primary proof and it contradicts the secondary proof, that you could change your mind and take the primary proof. This is not the only case that Sadhguru is talking about. I'm only applying Sadhguru's principle to our case. Okay? So therefore, in the case over here in the book, if it's true altogether, then the primary knowledge is contradicting the secondary knowledge. If that is true, then I must live. Logic can't tell me that secondary knowledge doesn't work. That's impossible. You can't live without it. But it's telling me that in this case, the primary knowledge is telling me in this case that I can't take the information from this secondary knowledge. But not that secondary knowledge doesn't exist. That's an impossibility. That can never happen because you wouldn't be able to exist without it. You couldn't make decisions in your life without it. But by us, it just so happens we also have a primary, in the proof of Har Sinai, we also have a primary proof. That is if you sit, in other words, there is a primary proof in the proof of Har Sinai, and that is this: there are God-made sciences and there's man-made. Okay, let's say chess. Okay, it's a whole system. Now, insofar as conceptually is concerned, you could reach a point conceptually where you finish the sequence. So you get to the bottom of the ground, you get to the bottom concept, and that's it. There's nothing more to get. In the world of God-made, like physics, okay, there is absolutely no end. In other words, they say that Einstein's theory of relativity is not science anymore, but it's like a philosophy. It's so abstract that it's like a philosophy, and that is not the end of the search. You see, there's no end. There's always more and more questions. They say for every answer we get in physics, they have 100 questions that follow immediately to show that there's no end. So therefore, when Einstein studied, when he came to his theory of relativity, he saw the system, God's system. He says, I cannot accept that there is not a being, something out there. His understanding, his definition of God was different, but he recognized that there must be a being. There must be a being out there. That is primary knowledge, where your mind sees it so clearly that you get an experience, an emotional experience. It's not the emotion that was the proof. That's just that it's real to you. So you get that. But when he sees in the universe this great idea, he cannot accept that there's no God once you see an idea like this. You cannot believe that an idea that there's no end to it could just happen by chance. That the whole system of physics will just happen by chance. You cannot accept that. It's not a chance thing. There must be something beyond. You see, that is... Now, when you learn Torah and you see in Torah the same thing, that no matter how deep you study it, you could always go deeper, then you reach a point where you must say that the Torah was written by God. So our primary knowledge... That is our primary knowledge. Primary knowledge means that you know on your own. You personally experience. Once you tell over that experience to the other person, it's secondary knowledge. So primary knowledge is you must experience it. So we say the same way that Einstein saw that there must be something beyond the physical world that couldn't have come out by chance. There must be something out there that brought it about. So we say that when you study Gemara, you'll find the same idea. So therefore, we say that when you start out, you must start out with the proof of Har Sinai, that secondary knowledge. But then you should sit down and learn Torah for 5 or 10 or 15 years, how long it takes, until you see primary, that you see the idea so clearly that there's no end to it, that you personally, through your logic, see this. Then you say that, then you must say that that it's primary knowledge. But you must reach that level of primary knowledge. Therefore, we must have secondary. So by us, the secondary and the primary knowledge would coincide, or should coincide. Okay, if you're learning correctly, it should coincide. But by the wounded knee area, by the 700 Indians, there's the secondary knowledge contradicts the primary knowledge. If I only had secondary knowledge, I would have to live with the secondary knowledge. Where it contradicts the primary, or the primary knowledge contradicts the secondary knowledge, then I must live by the primary knowledge and not the secondary knowledge. And since the prophecy never, you see, the prophecy never occurred, okay, it never happened, and you see physically that we're still around and the Indians didn't take over, so therefore you see that that's, I can't accept that secondary knowledge. The question is, there are many, many questions in the world about God's existence. In other words, first of all, they seem to have information from the physical world that there's no God, that God doesn't exist, or they have disproofs of proofs of God. So therefore, that should be primary knowledge, and proof of Har Sinai should be secondary knowledge. Therefore, there should be no God, right? But when I start out, in other words, I have primary knowledge that contradicts secondary knowledge. That's what you're saying. Is that correct? The question contradicts. I mean, in other words, the primary knowledge, which is the where my mind sees contradiction. So therefore, okay. Now, are there contradictions that in every science there are contradictions? So do we say whenever we see a contradiction that the physical world doesn't exist? Or do we say that let's understand and subdivide? In other words, like this. I see railroad tracks come together. Okay? Do I say, therefore, the railroad tracks don't exist? Because I know I know when I get there, I see they're not together. Okay? So which one? And here's both primary knowledge. Just one is close and one is far. But they're both primary knowledge, so what am I going to say? The physical world, some people do, that's why they ask this question. They say, therefore, you can't trust your 5 senses. But I say to them, practically, they can't live in this world. They might as well walk away. What we do is make a subdivision. There's what the real world is, and the way the 5 senses see the real world. Is that correct? Right. So I say, when you first have the question between primary knowledge and secondary knowledge, you should accept both and see if you could make a subdivision, just like in any science, you try to explain contradictions. That comes first. But where the contradiction is such where there is no subdivision, then the secondary knowledge loses. Where the primary knowledge is a question that there is no subdivision, then the secondary knowledge loses. It's not true. But where I have primary knowledge and secondary knowledge, and I can allow them to coincide, then because they're both proofs, then the first step is not to say I don't accept the secondary knowledge, but the first step is to try, just like any 2 facts where there are contradictions, I subdivide and try to explain how it works. So the same thing where you have primary knowledge and secondary knowledge, the first step should be to subdivide and try and explain. But if I cannot explain it, then I remove the secondary knowledge. The question is like this. A guy got in trouble, okay, and he says that since the 5 senses are faulty, so I didn't hear him do the wrong thing. I didn't hear him talk when he shouldn't be talking. That was the question, okay? The answer is, the question is a good question, okay? But the answer is, if this is the only tools that I have, to relate to the world outside of me, I have no other choice unless you can prove that I misheard. You understand? Or that I didn't hear, I made a mistake, if you could prove it. But if you cannot prove it, then I have no choice. Again, I want to get back to the idea that you start with an infantile type of security where there is no doubts in your mind, absolutely no question in your mind. You understand? But the fact is that in reality, there's a realistic type of security. It is not the same comfortable feeling that the infantile security has. But in the long run, you're better off with the reality type. So therefore, I have no choice. You cannot give up the infantile type of security, then you will not have that security, the realistic type of security. Yeah. According to the theory of evolution, every species exists very practically. It's very practical. In fact, the way the evolutionary process works, according to evolution, is that the species that is better off, in other words, within one species, if there's two types that come about, and one can survive better in the world, the other species will die out. The one that's better for survival will exist. Okay? Right. The question is that we are asking is in the human being, there are two components of the human being that the human being has that is not for survival. Okay? Einstein's theory of relativity and Darwin's theory of evolution shows that the mind was created not for practicality. In other words, there's no practical reason to know Darwin's theory of evolution. I mean, he's self-contradictory there. Or Einstein's theory, or any abstract ideas. Or when you ask the question, what is life about? Doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with practicality. That's one question. The second question, the emotions of the human is also not for practicality. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, a person is jealous. Jealousy means I just cannot tolerate that you have something, so either I destroy you, or I destroy the object that you have, or I have to get a better one, so yours is of no value in your own eyes. Right? That jealousy is not practical. So the fantasy of the human being is totally not practical. Okay? So the question is, why do we have these two areas that are not for the practical? In other words, even without the theory of evolution, if you look around the physical world, every animal operates totally practically, and scientists show that anything about the animal must have a practical reason for the survival of the species. I mean, without the theory of evolution, you see that. The human being is not that way. They have two components that is totally not in line with that idea of practicality. I mean, in other words, our species is unique than any other species. The question is, why is it that we have these two things? I agree from thought there might be certain things that will come out practically, but when it started, it only started for the enjoyment of thought. Then later, when we saw the ideas, so then we were able to apply it and use some of the ideas for practicality. But the original mind, I mean, but you could go back to the cave and live a very practical life with a club, and that's it. You go club an animal, you eat it, and that's it. Okay? Finish. What else do you need besides that? So Jonathan wants to take one step. The first step he wants to say that the creation of the human being is something beyond survival. There must be a different purpose. Okay? And Herschel says that the purpose is for free will. Because the thing is, it was created to extremes so that you can have free will. If you were only practical, there would not be any. You're like an animal. There would be no free will. The free will must demand that my mind works beyond the world of idea, beyond the world of the practical, and I can get above it. And I must be able to see the world incorrectly so that I can have free will. Which am I going to go? Look at life incorrectly or look at life correctly? So the only way I can have free will is if I have these two components. Okay? If you ask the question, what advantage does free will give me? It is no advantage because it's not practical. I don't need free will for practicality. For some reason, God wants the human being to have free will. Therefore, if that is my purpose, to have free will, then God must create a human being that has two possibilities, to live in line with reality or to live not in line with reality. So you must have two components, that can, one component to investigate reality and one component to look at the world incorrectly so that I can make my decision which way to go. It has nothing to do with practicality. It's only that God wanted a species to have free will. This is the way we have free will. Once again, if you even without evolution, if you look at the physical world today, every species is for the purpose of maintaining the species. That's all we see. Okay? The only one that is not so, that it has components beyond the practical, is the human being. Okay? And so therefore, and there are two components. One, I'm saying that shows that there, from the physical world, that God wanted a species with free will. Most of the time we accept free will because the Torah tells us. We accept Torah. But the thing is, I'm saying that you see from the species itself that there must be the only reason for these two components, these two opposite components, which is beyond the practical, would be for free will. I'm not saying that the mind or the emotions are useless. I'm saying they are useless only insofar as to maintain the species. But there is a purpose insofar as God's will is that there should be free will. So therefore there is a benefit in it, that you're fulfilling the will of God. But it has nothing to do with survival. And in evolution, in all animals, and we don't see this. We see that the human being was created totally differently. So if he's created differently, I have to understand what's the purpose of that difference is.